Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to the Stronger by Science Fireside Chat series. I am your host, Greg Knuckles. Thanks for coming back to this, the eighth installment of the Fireside Chat series. If this is the first one you're tuning into and you're expecting a lot of discussion of fitness and science and the things we cover on the normal episodes, you're not going to find it here. We're just going to talk about fun things that our listeners have suggested. These are at least supposed to be pretty fun, lighthearted episodes where we discuss off-topic subjects. So, yeah, that's what we're doing here, and I figure we'll get on into it. How are you doing today, Trex?
I am doing well, and quick message for those who have caught our previous Fireside Chats. The last couple times, our off-topic topics have been very on-topic, but this time, we actually are getting away from that stuff. Very off topic today.
Yes. Hopefully, I mean, we'll probably accidentally find a way to get on topic. Oh. I'm looking at the second question here in some of the notes you've jotted down. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, let's get right on into it. The first question that came in from one of our listeners is, what is the best way to motivate yourself? Or I guess how we're going to answer it, how do we go about motivating ourselves?
So motivation's tough, and I don't purport to have any expertise on this. Like I've never read the motivation literature, but I am a person who has at times needed to become motivated. And what has always worked for me is, this is kind of a cop-out, but just trying to limit how much effortful motivation I really have to conjure up. So, you know, I think we're pretty lucky given that most of the tasks we have to do are things that interest us and things that we believe should be done. Like we don't have some like higher up boss who's just telling us to do busy work.
Yeah.
Aside from Lindsay.
Yeah.
Who can be very tough. But no, I mean, so most of the stuff we do, we're passionate about it and we think it really ought to be done. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. So that stuff's pretty easy. But, you know, going back to times where I have needed to kind of dig deep and figure out how to get myself in the mindset to get something done, what I like to do is kind of reframe the task and find a motivation that makes sense to me. So like, if you're not motivated about doing the task for its sake, you know, so it's something that you're not passionate about, maybe you don't even think it really should be done, you have to find a way that it makes sense for you to actually be doing it. And so sometimes it might be, honestly, you might be kind of deluding yourself into thinking that it makes sense. But like for me, that's always been the way to do it. I have to understand that for me personally, there's a reason why it makes sense for me to be working on this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for me, that's been the easiest way to do it. And I can usually find some justification, like, it's better for me to do this than to not do it or mm-hmm. to procrastinate. And so however you have to kind of weave a narrative to make that work, that's been my go-to.
It's pretty similar for me. On a day-to-day basis, there aren't that many things I have to do that I just really, really don't want to do. But yeah, for the things that I don't have that much intrinsic motivation to do that I have to, you know, just put the nose to the grindstone and get done. Early on in my fitness career, I guess, the biggest motivation was probably to not wind up living under a bridge somewhere. So like, I mean, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but fresh out of school, didn't have much money, weren't making a ton of money. And so especially for like getting the coaching business off the ground, a lot of that was just like, look, I need to make some money or things are going to be really tight. And also, like, we didn't understand how tax law worked at all. So I was just dreading April coming. I was like, shit, we need to make a lot of money because I have no idea how big the tax bill to Uncle Sam's going to be. So like we had that sense of impending dread of like, we don't know how much money we need to make, but like there's a good chance that we'll be homeless in April if we don't make it. So that was, yeah, I mean, that was quite a motivator early on. Another thing that I think motivates me quite a bit is just like the ability to help people out. And I don't know, like I don't really consider myself a humanitarian or anything like that. But like we give a fair amount of money to charity, and like essentially once our basic needs are met and we're saving and putting away the amount of money that we want to make, beyond that, like we just donate most of it to charity. And so like, yeah, as far as like business stuff goes, the more money we make, the more money we have to help other people. And that feels good, you know? And then the last thing, and honestly, this is probably the biggest one. I am a very goal-oriented person. And I like to tick things off my to-do list. That just feels very good to me. And so if there's a task that I really, really don't want to do, this is an idea I picked up from James Clear. Declare my conflict of interest here. That is my wife's boss. But I picked this up before she worked for him. Like the idea is just getting started on something. So I think the example he uses in his article is like, okay, like if you know you need to go for a run, but you're not motivated to do it, like just lace your shoes up and say, I'm just going to take 5 minutes and go on a little jog. And 5 minutes later, if you're not just like utterly hating it, just keep jogging, you know? And if 5 minutes in, you do utterly hate it and it's just like really not something you have motivation to do, just quit. And at that point, you've only wasted 5 minutes, but you know, there is a chance that once you get going, you'll just keep going. And that is pretty much how I am. Like, it's really, really hard for me to get started on stuff sometimes. But then once I get started, I just zone out and just keep working until it's done. For me, like if I can just force myself to get over that hump and get something started, generally I can keep doing it even if I don't find it particularly fun or pleasant.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, my answer, it might make more sense if I give an example, you know? So I talked about just convincing yourself that something that's not worth your time is definitely worth your time and you know, or time and effort. Mm-hmm. So I took a course during my PhD that was on muscle signal processing. And like at that point in my PhD, I knew what kind of methods I used in my research. And that just wasn't it. Mm-hmm. I didn't do muscle signal processing. But I was like, you know what I could do? Like I have to take this class anyway, and I have to use the software that I think is ridiculous. I'm going to duplicate all of my homework assignments in R just to prove a point to someone. I don't know who. Nobody listened because I was like, dude, this is way better in R. But like, it's just like finding a way to take something where you're like, wow, this is not contributing to my anything I'm going to use in the future. But like, okay, but this will be fun and I'll prove a point to myself, I guess. And I'll pick up some skills that might actually be useful because the more I do in R, the better I get with it. So it's just that kind of thing of like reframing. But like you said, like you mentioned, like, oh, the more I do, the more I can give to charity. It's the same kind of concept of like, it's no longer about the task necessarily, but like doing this task brings me closer to doing something else that I really value.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And on a day-to-day basis as well, if there's something I don't particularly want to do, but I need to get done, when I get it done, I know. So I am like a classic procrastinator. But like one of the things that helps a lot is I have a lot of things I like to do when I'm not working. And also when I have something big hanging over me, I just enjoy my time that I'm not working less because I know when I get back to work, there's still this task that I need to get done that I hate. And so like p- part of it for me is just purely hedonic as well, where it's just like, there's this thing on my to-do list, I fucking hate it, but the hours of the day that I spend not working, I enjoy them less, and they're less pleasurable and less fun because this thing is still hanging over me. So just like, if I want to enjoy life, I need to get this shit done. And that's I think the biggest thing I use as a motivator to start tasks that I don't particularly want to do.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way, but I literally did that this morning. Like I was telling you, I woke up about 4 hours earlier than I planned to, mm-hmm. but there's been this task hanging over my head that I'm like, I got to do this. So yeah, this whole morning I was doing that exact thing because it's been like the time I'm not working, I'm thinking like, I got to do that at some point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Speaking of doing things, you want to talk about what happens behind the scenes at Stronger by Science?
Sure, let's do it.
Why don't you kick off this particular question?
Yeah, so one of our listeners asked, what happens behind the scenes of Stronger by Science? We're a small, scrappy company that is trying to compete with the big boys, I guess. And the only way we get that done is through massive amounts of verbal and physical abuse. Like, sometimes you got the stick, sometimes you got the carrot. And I don't particularly like carrots. It's interesting because, like, myself, Eric, and Lindsay are co-owners of Stronger by Science, so we don't necessarily have a boss that everyone reports to. So it's less like someone with a stick using it on everyone else, and more just like a circle of stick usage. So yeah, it's a very toxic but also productive work environment, I would say. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of anger and animosity and discomfort that really puts you in the sweet spot in terms of creativity.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of tension and no one feels comfortable really letting their guard down.
I do my best work when I don't have burning resentment because, you know, that's a distraction. You don't want that when you're working. But just like low-level seething resentment, that's what really puts me in the right mind space to get stuff done.
Perfect. Yeah. No, realistically, you know, like you said, it's a small company, right? I mean, there's the three of us plus Oswald.
Plus Oswald.
Oswald the dog. Most of the time, I'd say we're sitting at the desk and looking over papers that we're going to cite in an article, or maybe we're writing about it for Mass or whatever the case may be. And invariably, we'll start complaining pretty frequently.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes we'll come across something that's really good and we'll say like, wow, that's pretty cool. Good stuff. But we do a lot of low-level complaining, you know. Not super worked up or upset about it, but just like, oh, this again.
Yeah.
And we talk about research.
It's more complaining with a sense of resignation.
Yeah.
Because like all of the shit we see, we've seen a million times before, and we're like, oh, it's our good buddy confusing standard errors and standard deviations. You know, it's like an old friend that you don't particularly like.
Exactly. But one of the things, so this is my first job out of school, right? So like I did undergrad, master's, PhD all in a row, and then started doing this. One of the things that I find really interesting about our day-to-day operations is because there's so few of us, it's like every person has this weird mixture of input on really big picture stuff, but also handles like really mundane tasks. Like just the mixture of huge big picture stuff and really tiny insignificant detail stuff it's such a broad range of tasks that we do. And even just like the tasks themselves, right? So like, obviously like writing and coaching and audio editing and like just the different hats that you wear when you work at such a small operation is really fun, I think. I like being able to have a really rich mixture of tasks that are so different. You know,
because like, yeah, for sure.
I mean, I'm very introverted. I'm not gonna lie. I kind of like when I can just edit some audio for a few hours and just kind of block everything else out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean that's the day to day, right? We just kind of read research and write stuff and do audio and that's it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if someone's interested in what my day-to-day looks like, I'm generally working by 9:30. And then I use the morning when, you know, my brain's kind of getting woken up and I'm getting in a groove to just like respond to stuff. I have a big list of places where people might try to get in contact with me. So, you know, email, Facebook Messenger, Instagram, Twitter, Reddit, see if people have like requested any of my papers on ResearchGate, look at comments and see if we're getting a lot of like links from other websites, like just checking website traffic and comments. And so like I do all of that in the morning. And so if if I've ever sent you a message and seemed like I was in a bad mood, I probably was. I'm not a morning person. I am generally not as annoyed or surly as I might come across in online communication.
But, I mean, even outside of the morning hours, though, that is your kind of your digital communication style in messages.
Yeah.
You do tend to be a little bit more short with your language. Yeah. So the first few times that we started like interacting via like text message or Facebook message, I was like, damn, Greg's like, is he upset in general or is he mad at me? Like, I didn't do anything. But that's just kind of the way you talk.
Well, so yes. Reason for that is, I do that stuff from about 9:30 to 12. And so I've got like 2.5-3 hours of just people to respond to about random stuff pretty much every day. And, you know, it's a lot of time. And if I wrote like full, long, polite responses to everyone, instead of being 2.5-3 hours, it would be like 5 or 6 hours. Mm-hmm. And like, I just simply can't do that. And I have like this almost pathological need to respond to everyone. And I think like part of that is just kind of like how I think it's like based on my experiences as a young person who was interested in fitness and powerlifting. Because like, you know, I would look up to people and I would have questions for them or feedback or whatever else. And I get up with them and like, you know, 80% of the time they would just like ignore it. And, you know, that didn't like ruin my self-concept or anything, but like I didn't like it. It wasn't fun, you know? And so like I try to not do that to other people. And so we the reason we started the Q&A segment of the regular podcast actually was so when people ask questions, I could just be like, ah, well, fill out the Q&A form and we'll maybe address it on the podcast. I just like forgot about that within about 2 weeks and just went back to responding to everyone again. But yeah, so my online communication style, people do always think I'm mad at them, and I'm generally not. But yeah, I mean, it's just like I have to be quick and efficient if I'm going to be able to respond to everyone who wants a response about stuff. A lot of people say when they meet me, they're surprised at how talkative and effusive I am, because they're just like, whoa, this is not the vibe I got from like chatting with you on Instagram. Pro tip though, if you want me to seem less annoyed when I'm responding to you, don't message me on Instagram. Don't fucking text me. that might take a while to get a response. I hate text.
Dude, I haven't texted you in like probably 2 years.
Thank you.
There's no point.
I appreciate that. But yeah, like anything that primarily functions on mobile. So Instagram does have it. You can access messages on desktop now, but like it's still kind of glitchy, I think. But yeah, hit me up on Facebook or send me an email. I can type a lot more, a lot faster if I have a keyboard than if I have like a mobile keyboard. So yeah, my Facebook messages are probably like 6 times longer than my Instagram messages because I refuse to type a long message on my phone. Like, I'm just not going to do it.
Yeah, that's fair. And I'm not surprised to hear what you mentioned, like that people are a little bit surprised when they meet you in person, because in person you are very, I mean, several deviations from the median or the mean when it comes to just general jolliness. Like you are a far above average jolly fellow and quite outgoing.
Yeah.
But your online communication style, especially like you mentioned on certain platforms, is very far the other direction.
Very brusque.
Yeah, very brusque. And it's, there's nothing wrong with that. But I could understand why somebody would be like, what? who did I message online? Like,
yeah.
Who is the intern who's having a bad day answering these messages for you?
Yeah, no, it's always me responding. And I swear to God, I don't hate you as much as it seems like I do.
That's good to know. You want to talk about some sports?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's talk sports.
Oh, actually, I started with something and then got sidetracked.
Oh,
okay. So yeah, if you want to know what my day-to-day looks like, it's responding to stuff until about noon. And then I take like a 30-minute to an hour lunch break, where generally I'll eat something, maybe stretch a little bit, just kind of like hang out. And then from 12:30 or 1 until 5 on a short day, 6 on a long day, I try to work on kind of more important big picture stuff. So first half of the month, that's writing mass. Second half of the month, that's just like various other things. So the programs we put out, like that's, I worked on those during the afternoons. If I'm like putting a talk together, that's like I'll work on that during the afternoon. We're writing some books. So like when other stuff is ticked off my to-do list, like I'll work on my book in the afternoon. So yeah, like afternoon is kind of like more important long-term big picture stuff. But yeah, that's what my days look like these days. And then generally still maybe like twice a month, when Lens goes to bed, I'll put in like 5 or 6 hours on something overnight. Just like if stuff is backed up and I need to get something done during school, that was probably like 3 nights a week. And now it's like 2 or 3 nights a month, and that's very doable for me. But yeah, that's kind of what my work day slash month looks like.
Dude, when we first started hanging out regularly, I actually didn't quite know you at all. Like that was a don't you think it's fair to say that was a fully different version of Greg?
It was definitely a much more depressed version of Greg.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, you, whatever light is currently behind your eyes was fully extinguished.
Yeah,
at that time.
I was in a dark place.
Yeah, I mean, you were probably averaging 10 hours of sleep a week.
During my thesis project, yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise it was probably averaging 4 to 5 hours a night, closer to 4. But generally that would take the form of just alternating all-nighters.
Yeah, so yeah.
I'd pull an all-nighter, I'd sleep about 8 hours the next night, pull an all-nighter, sleep about 8 hours the next night, which sounds crazy. I actually felt and functioned way better doing that than if I just slept 4 hours every night. Because when I do that, there's a, like, one day of poor sleep, I'm perfectly fine. 2 days, like, things are quite a bit worse. And then, like, if I don't recharge and get a full night of sleep at some point, I just, like, slowly descend, and it just gets worse and worse on a day-to-day basis. And so with the schedule I was keeping, where it was like alternating sleep all nighter, sleep all nighter, basically I'd have one good day, one bad day, instead of all bad days, which, you know, doesn't sound great, but it 50% bad days is, it turns out, fewer bad days than 100% bad days. So it got the job done.
That should be like one of those motivational posters that are supposed to brighten your day.
Yeah.
50% bad days ain't so bad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I work less now than I think I have in my entire adult life. I put in probably 50 hours a week, give or take, 45, 50. During school, I was putting in 50-60 on the business, and then also was a full-time grad student.
Yeah.
And doesn't work out.
Does not work out.
All right. Sports. Do you want to...
Generally, yeah, in favor.
Yeah, cool. So person asks, if you were to compete in a sport that was neither a strength sport nor one of the big four or five spectator sports of the Western world, parentheses, football, soccer, baseball, etc., what would it be and why?
Yeah, so I've got two answers. Okay. One would be like, so it's hard to be good at a sport, right? So you basically have to decide for someone like us, like, what would you least suck at? You know what I mean? Like, sports are highly skilled endeavors. So which one would I be least bad at?
Well, it said if you had to compete in a sport, it doesn't necessarily say go pro in a sport, just compete in it.
Yeah, okay. Well, my answer still works. Okay. So the realistic one would be wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
I wrestled. It's not a big spectator sport, but it was great. I enjoyed it. I don't think I would enjoy it as much now. You know, time has been unkind to me. I don't know if I still have it in me, but it, you know, it was a fun sport. But man, when you try to take wrestling to a high level, so like, go watch a high school wrestling tournament. A lot of points. Someone's gonna win 14-6. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of pins. Go watch a college match, like two really good teams, 3-2, 2-1. When you get to that level, it becomes, no one makes mistakes. It becomes so difficult to score a point in any way. And so the really paradoxical thing about wrestling is the higher the level gets, the worse it is to watch. Because it just looks like a couple people that aren't doing much, but they're actually doing a billion things impossibly quickly and with such proficiency that no one has an opening.
Is that still the case with you? Like, I know a little bit about wrestling, but not much. And I feel like I would miss a lot of the really cool stuff that people are doing. Like, as someone like you who knows a lot about wrestling, is it still boring to watch like that level of defensive play?
So like, the wrestling hipster answer would be, oh, the highest level's the best. It's the nuances and the intricacies. But realistically, no, man. I like seeing the fireworks. Mm-hmm. Like, what's really fun is two people that are skilled but sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
Two really skilled wrestlers who just go for it and just swing for the fences.
Mm-hmm.
You will see that sometimes, you know, at like collegiate national tournaments and stuff. Mm-hmm. There are some really exciting wrestlers to watch, no question. But you do get a lot of those matchups at the really high levels where it's just two people who are never going to give an inch, who are just perfect, and there's not going to be an opening. It's somebody's going to win 2-1, you know? So wrestling, I've wrestled some people that actually were like Olympians and like, you know, international level talent. And I'm going to tell you, it wasn't fun. It's fine to watch, but man, some people are good at making you hurt.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out. So yeah, wrestling would be the answer. That like, if you were to tell me, hey Eric, you got to join a team or something right now, I'd say, okay, is there any wrestling going on? That's what I would do. But my other answer of like what I would be just impossibly bad at but would love, I would just pretend I was being competitive and do alpine skiing. I love going skiing. It is so much fun. I didn't start until like maybe 2 years ago. So I'm garbage at it, but I could go on for hours explaining why skiing is the best hobby. It's perfect, man. I love cold weather. I love snow. You're outside. I mean, it's always picturesque. It looks like you're like living in a postcard. It's just and there's like a little physical component as well. It's the best hobby. So I would say, oh yeah, I'm a super competitive skier, and I would just be last place at everything because I suck.
Sweet.
What about you?
Probably ping pong. So I'm good. I'm not great. If I'm playing someone else who's like a recreational ping pong player, I almost always win. Like, I don't think I've lost a game of ping pong since freshman year of college. But also, around that same time, which is when I was at my best, there were a few people who were very good at ping pong. So there was this guy, Daniel, who, oh man, I'm probably going to get canceled for this. He was from somewhere in Latin America, and I can't remember which. Like, I can't remember which country. But, like, he was from some Latin American country, and he was an alternate for their, like, Olympic ping pong team. So he never actually competed at the Olympics, but he was, like, next guy up if, like, their main guy couldn't do it. And so, I mean, like, I know what really, really good ping pong players are like, and I probably played Daniel over 100 games. Like, we played so much fucking ping pong because, like, next to Daniel, I was the next best person in the dorm. And so he liked playing against me because I was the only person who was even close to challenging him. But also, like, of the hundreds of games we played, like, we played, you know, to 21. I don't think I ever beat him. And I think I only broke 15, like, twice. And I think I only broke 10, maybe, like, a dozen times. So just a completely different level. So yeah. I don't think I could ever be, like, good, like, international good at ping pong. But I'm pretty good at ping pong. And I fucking love it. Like, it's so fun. It's ping pong and basketball are the two sports where if there are people near my skill level to play with, I will completely lose track of time and would be incredibly content just playing for an entire day. And so, yeah, I can't say basketball because that's one of the big spectator sports. So I'd probably have to say ping pong.
Yeah. I've told you this story. I had some roommates in college that they got a ping pong table and they played all the time. I mean, every day. And I wasn't as into it as everybody else, so I'd jump in from time to time, but they took such an exponential curve in terms of their skill development, because they were, I mean, the practice was just constant. And so every time I, like, checked in and, like, played a game, I would lose my more and more until eventually it was just like, this doesn't even make sense. Why would I pick up the paddle? Now, a related question here. What sport is the most fascinating to you or the most unbelievable to reach, like, a top level in?
So actually I want to go back and clarify my answer a little bit. So I flexed a little bit and I flexed a little too hard. So it has been a long time since I've lost a game of ping pong, but I don't want to make it sound like I play all the time. Like, I've probably played ping pong maybe 8 times since freshman year of college, because I moved into a different dorm without a ping pong table. And you just don't have that many opportunities to play ping pong in day-to-day life, unfortunately. I went to a party one time and some people were like, oh, let's play some pong. And I got super excited. Turns out they were talking about beer pong, and I have never been more disappointed in my life. But yeah, I mean, so, like, I'm super rusty. I can still beat other people who are very rusty. 19-year-old Greg would kick the shit out of me right now. But yeah, ping pong's cool. So, okay, what sport is most fascinating to me or most unbelievable to watch at the top level? So I have three. Two of them might be somewhat expected, and the last one probably isn't. So I think the most ridiculous sport to watch top level in is badminton. Because, like, I've played badminton and I'm fucking terrible at it, which is crazy because, like, I like racket sports. Like, I'm not good at tennis, but, you know, I'll go out there and swing the racket. And unless I'm playing someone good, like, I can get the ball over the net. Like, I can keep a rally going. I'm pretty good at ping pong. Badminton seems like it would be a similar skill set, and it's just not. Like, I'm trash at badminton, and I don't understand how people can be so good at it. And also, just watching them, not only do they hit the shuttlecock super hard, the defensive players, how are their reflexes so good? Like, you're watching it on TV or, like, streaming it. I can't even see the shuttlecock half the time, but, like, these motherfuckers are reacting to it and, like, you know, digging it I don't know if dig is the right term. Like, that's what it would be in volleyball. Like, they're digging it like 80% of the time. And I'm like, how the hell are you doing that? It's outrageous. So, yeah, I find top level badminton fascinating. And I can't even conceive of how they're that good.
Yeah, it's crazy. I took a badminton course during undergrad in college. Mm-hmm. And the instructor could not have weighed 105 pounds. Mm-hmm. There was no possible way. But I mean, she was like a force on the badminton court. Like, you would just be afraid to even like stand on the other side of the court because she would hit it 1,000 miles an hour. I couldn't believe the amount of power that she would generate when she hit it. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Next would probably be gymnastics, both male and female gymnastics. Takes so much strength, so much skill, so much coordination. I don't know what else there is to say. Like, top level gymnastics are absolutely outrageous. I have no idea how they do what they do. And the last one, this is probably the one people wouldn't expect, is Super Smash Brothers Melee. Competitive Melee, if you've ever played any Smash game, is outrageous. Because, like, the development cycle was rushed, and so there are some facets in the game that, like, the devs knew about but like didn't think would be all that useful that they just didn't patch out. And so like there's a lot of stuff that's like slightly glitchy but actually works really well for top level competitive Melee. And just like the actions per minute that they're inputting to make the characters do what they do is fucking outrageous. And like I'm decent at Super Smash Brothers Ultimate, which is like the newest game in the series, and everything after Melee removed all of those like high level options. And so like to be good at a current Smash game just doesn't require as much motor skill as the old ones did. Like it's more strategy and like conditioning your opponents. Like it's more of a chess match, whereas like Melee's fucking trench warfare. And top level Melee players are so ridiculously good. And also like Melee just runs on a faster engine. Like the whole game is faster, fall speed's faster. It takes so much skill. And if you've never played Melee before, you wouldn't have any concept for just like how fucking good they are. But like Jesus Christ, top level Melee is insanely entertaining.
I'm gonna be honest, when I saw that on the outline, I assumed that Melee was some I assumed it was some obscure sport that mm-hmm. I had never heard of, but I was like, oh, I'm going to learn something new today. This will be cool. I'm going to get, enriched with some knowledge of maybe a sport with some cool culture behind it. And I did not know Melee was a video game.
It is, yeah.
But I mean, video games are sports these days, right?
They are.
Yeah, esports.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'm not a big video game guy. Is that the game that I played with you one time?
You played Ultimate.
Ultimate. Okay. Yeah. Well, that alone was a bit too much for me to handle. I didn't do well.
Okay. What are yours?
Yeah. So to me, one of the things that I always try to remind myself whenever I see, I don't watch a lot of what Americans call soccer, rest of the world calls it football. I don't watch a lot of it, but when the World Cup comes around, you know, you're gonna tune in. Mm-hmm. Whenever I see someone who's a standout soccer player at the international level, I always remind myself the enormous talent pool of global soccer players.
Oh, yeah.
Like to me, that's the thing. Like the probability of being good enough at soccer with that global talent pool to actually be a standout at the international level is really mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. So for me, just the numbers behind that, I never get over how incredible you have to be relative to the average person.
Yeah.
You know?
The other thing I'll add about soccer as well is like when you think about other sports that have also really big talent pools, I feel like there's a bit more filtering because like physically soccer players I think do tend to be a little bit taller than average, but they tend to not have like super extreme body types.
Mm-hmm.
And so like if there's probably billions of people who have tried soccer. It's not like there's a filtering process where it's just like, hey, because you're too short, you can't possibly be good. Probably the two most popular sports in the U.S. are football and basketball, maybe baseball. And I guess baseball would be similar. Mm-hmm. It also doesn't select for as extreme of a body type, except for pitchers. With basketball, it's like there's a lot of people that play basketball. But in terms of making it to the NBA, you'll occasionally see someone who's like 6 foot, 6'1" succeed. And like there have been a couple people who are 5-something.
Right.
Like there was Spud Webb, there was Muggsy Bogues. But like
you can name all of them.
Yeah.
Which says a lot.
Yeah. But for the most part, it's kind of like you have to be this tall to ride this ride. Like
there is
theoretically a large talent pool of people trying to get in. But like people who are 6'3 are pretty fucking tall. Like if you see someone 6'3 in day to day life, you're like, oh, that's a tall person. They are considerably taller than most people I know.
Right.
But like they'd probably be the shortest guy on the court. With soccer, it's also like it's a combination of the huge talent pool and the fact that like there's not as extreme of a filtering mechanism. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think in many countries, there's also not as extreme of a filtering mechanism when it comes to socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a huge barrier to entry in the sport where like, you know, there are some sports where I know at least in America, it's like if you don't have money, it's hard to really get your foot in the door and play at a young age. So I think soccer is just so accessible on so many levels that, the talent pool is enormous.
I have no idea what the socioeconomics of soccer look like around the world.
I don't know.
In the U.S., dude, soccer's still a fucking expensive sport.
It is in the U.S., big time. Yeah.
Americans have just figured out how to make every youth sport as expensive as possible.
Soccer is expensive. Baseball is expensive. Football was expensive when I was a kid.
Didn't you say you went to a wrestling camp that was like thousands of dollars?
No.
Or that you knew about one?
Oh, there's all sorts of wrestling camps like that. Yeah. The one I went to was a little on the cheaper side, but we also slept on the mats. we were in a barn in July with no air conditioning, sleeping on the mats.
Yeah.
So it's hard to charge a premium for that.
Yeah. I mean, so you talked about how expensive it is to get noticed in some sports. I mean, that's how sometimes, like, great talent slips through the cracks.
Yeah.
Mike Trout, probably the best baseball player today. And if not, like, certainly the best position player over the last decade or so. You can make a case for some other people, like, in this season. Incredibly good. Has been good for a long time. Was good from the moment he entered the minors. But it was like his parents wanted him to have a more normal life. And so I'm pretty sure he did play like AAU, USSSA ball, but like didn't travel to all of the big showcase tournaments where like all of the scouts were going to be. And so, you know, when he was in high school, he was playing against good competition and fucking murdering them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because his parents didn't want baseball to turn into like a $30,000 a year sport for a teenager, he just didn't get the looks that he could have and should have. And like, you know, now he has something ridiculous. It's like a $400 million contract. So like he's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that there are players who aren't quite as good as Mike Trout, who probably just like slip through the cracks and don't get drafted, don't get the opportunities they should have, just because like either their parents were unable to shell out that kind of money, and it's a lot of money, or were just like unwilling to, because it's like, dude, you're fucking 14. I'm not going to spend $3,000 every other weekend for you to fly to some big showcase.
Yeah. Now, I will admit I've made some assumptions when I was thinking about socioeconomic barriers. I was just thinking, do you have the equipment to play ball?
Oh.
And, you know, with soccer, it's like,
no, I was
you roll
thinking,
out a ball in the, you know, if someone in your neighborhood has a ball, everybody's good.
No, but I was thinking all of the scouting infrastructure and shit for U.S. sports.
Yeah, thinking of that side of it, I know soccer in America is pretty expensive because they do a lot of the big showcase tournaments. It's like a lot, but
yeah.
I don't know if that's the way it is internationally. So someone will have to educate me on that.
So I think that there are, I know at least in some countries there are like development academies, and I have no idea what the process of getting into one of those looks like. You know, if it's just like open tryouts, or like if the like payers' parents have to like play for them, like it's a private school. I could see that in some countries being an economic barrier, but I just don't know what the economics of development academies look like.
Yeah, I have no idea. But yeah, so soccer, I think, is if you can stand out that much with that many talented people playing soccer globally, I think that's incredible. Another thing that kind of blows my mind is, you know, back in the day when I was a kid, they would play this on ESPN like during the day in the summer. Mm-hmm. But all of the billiards type sports, like you would turn it on and you would see people playing pool or playing, like, you know, throwing darts or bowling or something. Those little skills that, like, you know, you go to a bar on Saturday night, there's a dartboard or a pool table. Like, we all know how hard it is to do that stuff efficiently. Mm-hmm. And when you watch, like, you ever watched professional players playing pool?
They're very good.
Dude, if you miss, you're done. Like,
generally, yeah.
Yeah, like,
unless you hit a awesome safety.
Yeah.
Like, if you're playing, like, 8-ball or 9-ball, and, like, you know you don't have a shot, you might be able to set up a good safety.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like when you're playing with your buddy and it's back and forth and back and forth. It's like if you miss a couple shots in a game, you can almost be certain that you lost that game. Mm-hmm. Like the precision of, you know, professional dart throwers or bowlers or pool players, I just find that to be incredible, because I've tried that skill and it is really hard. Like, I've tried all those things.
Yeah.
I don't understand how they're that good at it. Okay.
Have you ever watched snooker?
What is that?
So someone might be about to come in and correct me here, but like from watching a little bit of it, to me at least, it seems like pool on hard mode. So it's a similar thing. Like you're hitting balls with a cue, and like you're trying to like make them in the pockets, but like there's a lot of balls going on, and like I think some of them have to be hit in particular pockets, and like I think they have to be pocketed in a particular order. And also, if memory serves, the actual pockets are smaller on a snooker table, and so you have to be even more precise. So like I didn't even know snooker was a sport. Like, I don't think anyone plays snooker in the US. Like maybe in the Northeast. Like I've heard some of my family from New Jersey like reference snooker before, but like no one plays snooker in the South. But I just, so the YouTube algorithm recommended me one time like the best career plays of Ronnie O'Sullivan, who's like one of the all-time snooker greats, and I was like, okay, whatever, I'll check this out, what's going on here, dude? It was really fucking impressive. So yeah, if you enjoy watching top level pool treks, you should check out snooker at some point.
I'll have to do that. You know, one other kind of random highlight reel that really caught my attention that I didn't expect. Mm-hmm. If you've never watched sumo highlights,
dude,
sumo is a very fun sport to watch.
So me and Lindsay were actually talking about this recently. Sumo highlights are fun to watch.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever want to go to a sumo tournament.
Why is that?
So I'm probably going to get some of the details wrong here. And yeah, there's probably going to be some sumo enthusiasts who email us very upset. But I think like the broad strokes of what I'm about to describe are correct. So sumo highlights, what you're seeing is a whole sumo match. When someone's back hits the mat, I guess it's not a mat, but like when someone's back hits the ground or there's a ring out, like that's it. You know, they're not doing best of five or anything. And so you see those highlights, they're like 5 seconds, maybe 10 seconds if it's a particularly long match, that's it. And then with sumo, like there's like a ritual that they go through before each match. And so like a tournament might have like 30 sumo wrestlers in it. And so there's going to be 15 matches a day, and they have to go through like a relatively long ritual every single time before the match starts. And so, you know, a lot of people complain about American football because there's you know, maybe 6 seconds of action followed by like 30 seconds of downtime. So sumo, it's similar. There's like 5 to 10 seconds of action followed by like minutes and minutes of downtime, like way, way more than the NFL. And a sumo tournament lasts for, I believe, 15 days.
Whoa.
So I'm pretty sure there are 4 a year. And like, you know, for top level sumo, I don't know about like lower levels, but for top level sumo, I'm pretty sure there are 4 tournaments a year. Each wrestler wrestles once per day, and it's, you know, 5 or 10 seconds. And so when last I checked, the number one Yokozuna in the world was Haku Hosho. So if you're a big Haku Hosho fan, you're going to get like 5 to 10 seconds of action today. You're going to sit through the rest of it. You come back tomorrow, you get another 5 to 10 seconds of hot sumo on sumo action. And then like you do that for 2 weeks straight. And also, like, you know how painful it is to sit through the off season in football? It's like, okay, you know, there were 4 or 5 months of games, but like now I have to wait for like 6 months for football to come back.
Yeah.
That's like the life of a sumo fan. Yeah. Because you get approximately 2 weeks of action, and then you have a full off season. You have 3 months off before sumo comes back. And so, like, yes, sumo highlights are very cool. Sumo wrestlers are insanely good athletes, but I think that it would be very frustrating to be like a huge, huge sumo fan.
Yeah, you'd have to develop a very different level of just patience with the sport. Yeah, that'd be challenging. All right. Do you want to move on from the realm of sports?
Let's do it.
Do you want to skip this one and go to the next two?
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, let's go into that. This is an interesting question. I have to assume we've at least kind of touched on this at some point during the podcast, but
I made a YouTube video about it back in the day and people got ass mad about it.
Oh, God. Why did they get mad? So, okay, the question is why we've stayed steroid free, or the prompt, I should say. So why did people get mad last time you talked about this?
Because the last time I talked about it, it was not that long after I set my last world record. And so it was just, and this was also like kind of at the peak of fake natty hysteria.
Yeah.
And people were like,
McCarthyism in the fitness space.
Yeah. And so people were like, like, you're just trying to deflect. Like, the fact that you made this video counts as an admission that you're on a lot of shit. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see how this goes.
Well, this is going to suck for me because no one's going to believe that I'm natural. with my physique, come on.
So what are your reasons? You can kick this one off.
Yeah, so it's, I know I've mentioned this part on the show before. When I was like 18, I got to college and just ate everything in sight and lifted like most hours of the day. Mm-hmm. Got some quick gains, and I didn't read much at the time. I assumed that that would continue linearly almost forever. And so, like, I got it in my head at the age of about 18 and a half, like, I could be, like, a Jay Cutler, Lee Priest type physique. reality brought me back down to earth eventually. But there was a moment there where I was like, what if I just leaned into this hard and just, like, said, you know what? The drugs, yes. Whatever you're offering, all of it, I'll take it. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it and then did some reading before I made that jump, because it's a pretty serious jump to make.
Yeah.
And for me, it really just came down to, at the time, pro hormones were all over the market. Or, I mean, they were just essentially oral anabolics, basically. But you could go the route where you got, you know, the legal stuff mm-hmm. that was on the shelves at supplement stores. But that stuff, based on everything I was reading, was like awful for your liver.
Yeah.
And I was like, I know I'm young, but like, I might live a while and I want to have a liver the whole time.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was like kind of, I wasn't really fond of that idea of doing the legal stuff. And then the illegal stuff, to me, based on what I was reading, seemed like it actually might be kind of the healthier route. But I didn't want to be committing like pretty serious crimes all the time. Like, I didn't think it was ethically or morally wrong, mm-hmm. as long as you're not like cheating, right? So if you're doing steroids and then competing naturally, I do think that's an unethical thing.
Yeah.
But if you're not cheating anybody in the process and you're just, you know, doing steroids. I didn't see that as a moral issue.
Yeah.
But I was just like, yeah, I'm not comfortable with the legal liability of, you know, obtaining steroids all the time. I was also really put off. I started reading on forums and stuff that you had to like actually think about what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how are you going to manage your cycle and your, you know, post cycle therapy? And I was like, dude, this seems like a lot of work and thinking. I don't want to do any of that. So it was a combination of not being ready to become an amateur endocrinologist and not wanting to take stuff that was going to just wreck my liver and not wanting to take on the legal liability of having to actually obtain and possess steroids as a controlled substance. So for me, that was really it. It was a matter of the effort involved, the liability involved, the potential health ramifications, and honestly, the cost. Mm-hmm. I was a college student when I was at the age of where I was like, oh, maybe I'd think about it. I didn't have any money. So even if the other things didn't deter me, I wouldn't have been able to afford it anyway.
Yeah.
So that was pretty much it for me. What about you?
So for me, the liability was definitely a big one as well. So one of the things that I think a lot of people don't consider is like, oh, okay, like if you're going to do gear, what type of gear are you going to do and how much are you going to do? And then like, it's one of those things where I'm a relatively extreme person by nature. And so like, I know a fair amount of people who are on like just test and like a slightly higher than TRT dose of test. And by slightly higher, I mean like 2 or 3 times higher, but you know, like 0.25 gram or like 300 milligrams of test per week, which is like, that's more than people are putting out naturally. Like they're getting some super physiological stuff going on, probably building a little more muscle than they otherwise would, almost certainly building more muscle than they otherwise would. And like a lot of these guys are in their 40s and like they just found a very understanding doctor that was just like, yeah, okay, I'll write you a pretty liberal TRT prescription. And with stuff like that, one, like, you know, it's not like there are no risks, but risks are constrained to some degree. And two, if you were going that route, like basically very aggressive TRT test only route, and you were going through, you know, black markets, then if you got busted, you might actually have pretty manageable liability. So if they busted you for possession, and especially if you have no priors, they're probably not going to come down on you super hard. But the problem is, like, I know myself. I'm an extreme person. If I were to do steroids for powerlifting, I would want to, instead of competing like relatively near the top of drug-free lifting, I'd want to compete near the top of untested lifting. And like, more stuff is generally good, you know? And so going back to the liability thing, if you look at American drug laws and how like the amount of steroids you need to have for them to be able to pin possession with intent on you, it's like
intent to distribute.
Yeah. It's less than a relatively aggressive steroid cycle. Like most people who are taking high doses of stuff, if they're planning like a 12-week cycle out, if the feds knocked on their door when they were in like week 2 or 3 of their cycle, they'd get them for possession with intent. And that's serious jail time. And so like,
it's like decades, right?
It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, for me, it's like, I mean, I'm certainly not like opposed to TRT. And like, if someone just wants to run a little bit super physiological to like get a little out of it, their liability is probably constrained. I don't see a problem with that, but like, that's not me, you know, like that's, I think if I was going to go on, I would go on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, one of the big things for me is like, I don't want to get arrested and do decades because like, I just wanted to get big. So that was one of the things. Another thing is, there are quite a lot of heart problems in my family. Like, heart issues are what kill Knucklesmen. And so like, I already have elevated risk for that. And you know, steroids generally increase your risk of heart disease. And so, like, I don't need to further increase my risk of heart disease. Like, that's one of the considerations.
That was one thing I wanted to add to my statement. The way that I phrased it made it seem like the pro hormones were bad. The steroids, totally fine. I don't want to give that impression. There are definitely some health risks, yeah, even with the injectables.
Another thing for me is, like, a lot of it's just like curiosity to see what I can do drug free. So, like, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. I've had these numbers in my head for a long, long time. Like, I want to squat and pull 8 and I want to bench 5. And I'm just really fucking curious to see if I can do that without drugs. And, like, from, I mean, after I was in the sport for like 2 years, I've mostly lifted for myself. Like, I don't, like, I'm not going to play the USLP, the USAPL game and, like, go to nationals and, like, try to qualify for worlds. Like, I have no interest in spending thousands of dollars and, like, taking a bunch of weekends and a shitload of time to compete all the time. Like, if someone wants to go that route in powerlifting, I'm not going to yuck your yum. Like, you do you. That's not why I lift. Like, there are numbers I want to hit and I want to hit them for me. And so, like, I don't want to take gear that would, like, cheapen those achievements for myself. So, like, that is one of the considerations. Another consideration, going back to health stuff, is, like, the fact that steroids are illegal means that, like, you have to assume the risks that come with buying stuff from the black market. And the thing is, like, just from talking to people who are in that world, apparently, like, some people are competent, good procurers and distributors of steroids. And but, like, when you look at the research of, like, you know, scientists go and, like, procure a bunch of gear on the black market and then test and see what's in it, one of the issues you can have is, like, you plan out a cycle, you get your stuff, your cycle's fucked because your stuff doesn't actually have the stuff in it that you thought it did, you know? So, like, that's one problem. Another problem is, like, a lot of the products that one could buy via the internet are, like, pretty heavily contaminated with stuff, specifically heavy metals. So, you know, bunch of health problems there, potentially a bunch of brain problems there. So, you know, it's one of those things where, like, you need to, it's probably not a world to dabble in. Like, you probably need to get in deep enough to make good enough relationships with, like, distributors that one could trust. And, like, I didn't particularly want to venture into, I mean, I'm not saying it should be, but what it is now is essentially a criminal underworld, just because of how drug laws in the US work. I didn't want to have to, like, venture in deep enough that I could find a distributor that I trusted, you know? Like,
yeah,
if I was going to try something, I just want to, like, be like, ah, I'm just going to dabble. I'm going to buy something off the internet. But, like, I wouldn't trust stuff that I just bought off the internet because those are risks associated with operating in a black market. And then the last thing, going back to health risks, is when people think about health risks associated with steroids, they tend to think heart issues, they tend to think liver issues, you know, other, like, more vanity related things that someone might think about is, like, baldness, acne, like, testicular shrinkage, stuff like that. The potential side effect of steroid use that scares me the most personally is, there's some research that suggests that steroids have negative effects on the brain and on cognition. So keep in mind here, this is cross-sectional research. You could never, you would never get an RCT by an IRB. Like, if you're like, hey, we think that steroids might rot your brain. So we're going to recruit some people and give half of them a placebo and half of them a dose of steroids we think that might rot their brain and see if it rots their brain. Like, no IRB is going to sign off on that. But the cross-sectional research that's out there suggests that compared to, like, matched controls that are matched across as many variables as possible, people who use steroids tend to have lower brain gray matter, and like some quantifiable aspects of intelligence are lower. So, you know, not like every facet of intelligence that one could quantify, but like some, I think specifically like verbal reasoning tends to be a little bit lower. And so the thing is, like, you know, I'm not making a causal statement here. Again, there aren't RCTs. Like, this is just from cross-sectional research. But it's enough to scare me because, I mean, ultimately, I make my living with my brain and I make my living by writing. And so, like, if they do decrease brain gray matter and if they do... and I'll just note as well, like, it's not only cross-sectional research. Like, it is known from like in vitro studies that high enough levels of androgens can be neurotoxic. It's also known that like some specific steroids, primarily thinking tren here, tren is directly neurotoxic. And so like that bothers me, you know, because ultimately I make my living with my brain. And if I got a lot bigger and stronger, but was able to do my job less well, that wouldn't be great. And so that is another thing that has kept me away from steroids.
Yeah. And I think it is important to say, you know, like I don't advocate for steroid use. I've never in my life been like, hey, you know what you should do? Use steroids, because the health ramifications and the legal ramifications are enough for me to be like, yeah, not, definitely not for me, and nothing I'd feel comfortable recommending to anybody. Mm-hmm. But it's also like in the lifting world, some people use steroids. Yeah. I have zero problems with you using steroids. You know what I mean? Like, if you know the risks you're assuming and you're not cheating, I have literally no problem with you.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that as well. Absolutely no problem with steroid usage. If you want to do it, do it. I could not give less of a shit. But yeah, just not for me.
Because, you know, some people get this question, they kind of answer it from
like a moralistic perspective.
Yeah, like oh, I wouldn't possibly stoop to that. Like, it's not at all that. Like, like I said, if you do steroids, I have literally no problems with you. You know, as long as you're informed about the risks you're assuming, just like anything. Like, I probably drink more than would be optimal for my health. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, based on the numbers per week, I'm probably a little over what I should drink.
Yeah.
I know that risk. Mm-hmm. I like bourbon and beer. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
You know, so like, I see it as the same thing, you know?
Well, I mean, so like, I'll feel comfortable sharing this, I think. At some point, once I hit the numbers I want to hit, there's a part of me that kind of wants to just like lean down and get super shredded one time just to see what yeah. just to see what it's like. What I don't want to do is I don't want to deal with like the low energy induced hypogonadism that comes with like getting that shredded. And so like an idea I've been bouncing around in my head is like, well, if I go that route, if things really start going south, I might just hit up an endocrinologist and be like, look, can you write me a TRT prescription like to finish this cut? Because like, dude, you know, it's one of those things, I want to see what I look like to get super shredded. And I'm also, I think I'd be fine dealing with the hunger, like, but a lot of the side effects that we've talked about that come with natural bodybuilding, they just sound fucking miserable. And I don't want to be a natural bodybuilder. Like, I don't want to live that life. So like, yeah, I have already considered maybe getting a little chemical help to get there. Like, not super physiological levels, but like enough that like it's not like my dick won't work for 6 months, you know? And so like I don't think that that's dissimilar from, you know, someone who just like for the fun of it is just like, let's see how fucking thick, solid, tight I can get, and they want to run a bunch of gear. Like, I don't see a problem with that at all. So yeah.
Now, you mentioned that you don't want to be a natural bodybuilder. Have you put any thought into being a natural classic bodybuilder?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you from being there, the hunger, it's fine. It's really not bad. the things that suck are, like you said, the low testosterone and the low thyroid hormone. Mm-hmm. Those two things, you're freezing all hours of the day, literally in the middle of July in North Carolina, freezing. And yeah, just living with low testosterone is not a fun way to live.
Yeah.
At all. So this next question is kind of, it's like kind of similar, I guess, right? It's along the lines of ergogenics.
Sure.
So the question is, if you could take a pill to make you smarter, would you do it?
Yeah. Like, I don't know. I don't even have to think about that. Of course I would.
See, I think you should think about it.
So it would depend on the side effects. Like, you know, if it's like you can take a pill to make you smarter, but then like you're going to die in 2 years. Like, yeah, probably not. But if it's just like no strings attached, you take the pill, you get smarter, nothing else happens. Like, yeah, dude, for sure.
So, okay, we talked about this off air a few weeks ago, which is technically cheating, but my initial answer was no. And you talked me out of it. I will admit you made some good points, but my answer now is yes, but I have some reservations. I still have some concerns. My question is this just making me smarter, or is it making me have like superhuman intelligence? Because I think those are two very different things. Mm-hmm. If something was making me smarter to a degree I could control, like, oh, I'm going to up the dose and go for 6 capsules moving forward. Like, if I had some control over it, I'd like that. But if it was just like a thing that makes me superhuman smart, I think there would be some drawbacks there to some extent. Like, I think if you were that much smarter than every person around you, I think that could lead to some frustration. Like, if you've ever tried to teach something to somebody that's just not getting it, if you don't really have the patience of someone who's like made to be a teacher, it can be kind of frustrating. And I do wonder if that would lead to a lot of frustration. If just like, if you were that much smarter than everybody around you, I could see that potentially being a little bit annoying. And I also wonder if it would be, and I'm talking about superhuman intelligence here, I wonder if it would be difficult to socialize with people and really relate the same way if you were that much smarter. So like, those are my initial thoughts, and that's why I was like, nope, I'm good. But you did talk me into it, but I'm still a little bit concerned about those things.
So first, I think we need to operationalize some terms. What does it mean to be smarter? Like, how are we quantifying and operationalizing that?
I don't know.
Because, like, so from, so kind of like on a mechanistic level, if you're talking like general intelligence, a lot of that seems to simply be how efficient your brain uses energy and just like how quickly it can churn through energy. Because a lot of that relates to just like processing speed and power. Like a computer analogy is a bad analogy for the brain, but like that's what I'm going with. Like that ultimately determines like your brain's processing power. And like if your brain has greater processing power, one, you can take in and assimilate information faster. And then one of kind of the hallmarks of someone with high intelligence, like one of the things they can do is they can contain more information in short-term working memory and manipulate it better, essentially. So, you know, for example, someone with really low intelligence, you know, I'm not talking like someone who's just learning math, but someone who just has like low intelligence might really, really struggle to add a one-digit number to a two-digit number where you need to carry a one. Because like you need to keep the two numbers in your mind. You need to like keep the carrying the one in your mind. And like that's like 4 or 5 like bits of information that they need to have in their mind that they need to be able to work with and manipulate. Whereas someone who, I think there are actually like tricks to do this, like multiplying big numbers together, but assuming you don't know the tricks, someone with like crazy, crazy high intelligence might be able to multiply like 2 7-digit numbers together with like the same the same ease and speed that it might take someone else to like add 2 3-digit numbers together, which is something that like most people can do, but does take a fair amount of mental effort. And so like that's ultimately kind of what's going on with high intelligence. Like you can assimilate information and like manipulate more pieces of information in your working memory, or manipulate the same pieces of information in your working memory faster. Like there are other facets of intelligence, but that seems to be like one of the biggest ones.
I'm concerned because I'm particularly bad at the things you're describing right now. I don't like that.
We can cut that from the episode.
So here's my, have you ever looked into any research? Like are more intelligent people generally happier or more content? Have you ever seen research on that?
I don't know about that. It kind of depends on what you're talking about, because like it's hard to disentangle a lot of factors.
Right.
So people who have like outlier intelligence tends to be associated with higher rates of some mental illnesses. But then the question is like, you know, is it that there's like an underlying factor that might be causing those two things, and that like the intelligence itself isn't related to the mental illness at all, but there's
right,
like
yeah.
a common factor causing both of those
right.
things.
That'd be very hard to try to untangle that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing is like, I think happiness generally tends to increase with intelligence up to a particular point, but earning power tends to as well. And so like that's also difficult to disentangle. Like
the socioeconomic
right,
comfort level.
Right.
Yeah.
Like what is causing what there.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, I don't know if you could strictly ascribe causality to anything going on there.
Right. Yeah. So that's kind of my thing is like, I would definitely like to be more intelligent than I currently am. I just worry if you became that much of an outlier, you know, if this hypothetical pill gave you like superhuman intelligence, I wonder if that might be a bit more isolating and a bit more frustrating than you might initially think. Mm-hmm. I wonder if when you are like truly outlier, superhuman smart, if you would regret that decision to take this fictitious pill.
I mean, I don't know. So I think the biggest question for me is like, is it reversible? Like, is this a pill?
No.
It's not.
It's not.
I think I'd still send it.
Fair enough, man. Yeah. No, you definitely talked me into it. I just, you would dive in head first and I would cautiously wade into the scenario, but I'd still probably take it.
I think those are just like generalizable facets of our personalities.
Yeah, that's true. That's definitely true.
All right, let's shut it down. Well, thank you for listening to this, the 8th installment of the Stronger by Science Fireside Chat series. Yeah, thanks for tuning in. If there are any topics you'd like us to address, you can fill out a form located at tiny.cc/SBSQA to submit those questions or topics. If you like the show, feel free to rate it on iTunes or, you know, wherever you get your podcasts. If you don't like it, you can also rate it. That's fine, I guess, but please don't. And if you're listening on YouTube, like, comment, subscribe. It really does help. And that's about it. Hope life is treating everyone well.
Thanks for listening to the Stronger by Science podcast. Now, Greg and I are not experts in medicine or health or really anything else for that matter. So before you make any changes to your diet and exercise habits, make sure you check with a doctor or another healthcare professional. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to support it, visit StrongerByScience.com to check out the products and services that we offer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.